Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is now 3:18 p.m. It is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017. Before we begin, I would like to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, and Kelsey Goodell from the Juno LIO, who make sure we have sound and a transcript of our committee meetings. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have currently Representative Eastman, Representative Reinbold, Representative Ledoux, Representative Fansler, my vice chair, and myself, Representative Clayman, and we do have a quorum to do business. Our first order of business today is a confirmation hearing. The Speaker has referred the following governor's appointment to the Judiciary Committee: Attorney General, Department of Law. Members have received the appointee's application and resume. The appointee is present and will testify. We will now open public testimony. Ms. Linda Muth, go ahead. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Clayman, and the rest of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I just have short remarks. I know we're a little bit behind schedule. I'm happy to answer any questions you have. I thought I'd just start with telling you a little bit about myself. So I was born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska. My parents came up with the military in the mid-60s, and I was born on Elmendorf. And then after my dad got out of the military, he decided to stay in Alaska like many families do, and that's how my family came to Alaska. So I attended West High School, and I've only gone outside for school. So I went outside for my undergraduate degree at Drew University in New Jersey. And I went to, I came back for 3 years after undergraduate and looked at a social work career and worked in that field for a couple of years before deciding to go to law school. I went to UC Berkeley in Berkeley, California, and graduated there in 1997, Order of the Coif, which for non-lawyers means top 10% of that law school. And I returned to Alaska. I clerked for Justice Robert Eastaw on the Alaska Supreme Court, and then joined the law firm of what was then Bogle and Gates, that then became Dorsey and Whitney just short 4 months later after I joined. So I've spent my entire career at that one law firm before joining the state. I worked my way up. I was an associate, a baby attorney, and then became a partner. And then the last 8 years before becoming the Attorney General, I was the managing partner of Dorsey's Anchorage office. So Dorsey Whitney is an international law firm. It has more than 500 attorneys, but we've had anywhere between 8 and 18 attorneys in Anchorage. So that is just a little bit about my background. We can start there. Do you want a little bit more about how I came to be the Attorney General?
Sure. Would folks like to hear? Sure. Go ahead and let us know about how you came to be Attorney General.
So in 2015, I was very involved with the Fairbanks 4 pro bono case. I spent more than 1,000 hours on pro bono work that year. And the public service bug just really hit me. And I, while we were in trial in that case in October of 2015, Justice Dana Fabe announced her retirement, and that seat on the Alaska Supreme Court became open. And I decided while I was in trial in that case that would be something that I'd like to do with my next step in my career. So that application was due 2 days after closing arguments in that case. So I came back and I filled out my application and turned that in. And for the non-lawyers, that application process and going through judicial counsel is a very complicated and fairly intense process. It takes about 6 months. So there's peer review, and all of the lawyers that know you can weigh in on you. And then it goes to the judicial counsel, and they make the recommendations on who should go for the short list that the governor can appoint from. I made it onto the short list out of the judicial counsel, and my name was put forth to the governor for consideration for the Alaska Supreme Court. I had my interview with the governor last April of 2016. And although I had known the governor before that time, known of the governor before that time, because you know, in my law career, it was general commercial litigation practice, covering a bunch of different areas. I had done some oil and gas, natural resource type work, and so you know, I knew of him and he knew of me, but we actually had not met before that interview in April of 2016. So I went through that interview process. And the outcome of that, of course, was that Justice Sue Carney was appointed to the Alaska Supreme Court in middle of May of last year. And then in June, I received a word from the governor's office to come meet with the governor. And I was like, you know, what business does the governor have with me? And at that point, Attorney General Craig Richards had not yet resigned his position publicly. And so I went and met with the governor, and he asked me to be the attorney general. And I did think about it for probably 2 days, just because it was such a different turn in my career. It's not something that I'd ever considered or thought about, but it was definitely a privilege and an honor to be asked to take this position, and I have had no regrets since then in accepting this position. It's truly an honor to serve the state in this role. I really do enjoy all of the people at my department and working on all of these important legal issues for the state.
Question. Representative Reinbold has a question. I see. Go ahead, Representative
thank
Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, first of all, I want to thank you for being here today. I want to thank you for coming to Eagle River. I really appreciated the day that you drove to Eagle River and spent a long time listening to me about heartfelt concerns, and that was a first, and it was a big deal for my community, and I really want to say thank you for that. I also want to thank you for your advocacy toward abused women, in particular, and children. And I've seen you in a different light. I've seen you in action, and it's been very impressive. And I really feel like we're kindred spirits in that area. Today, I have to ask some tough questions. It's not because
I'm going to let you ask the tough questions, but let me just note for the record that we have now been joined by Representative Kopp and Representative Christ Tompkins. Go ahead. Thank you for that brief interruption.
Oh, no problem. First of all, I just want to thank you. I think this is one of the most important jobs in the state, and it's us on this committee that is our opportunity to give the people of Alaska just a light into who you are and what you think this role is. So with that in mind, I'm going to ask you a couple tough questions with the indulgence from the chairman. But first of all, we're in a recession, big recession. The Department of Law has grown, as you know, 40% in the last 7 or 8 years, according to one of your staffers. We have a huge deficit. The people of Alaska are suffering and hurting. What are you going to do to help us close the fiscal gap?
Ms. Linda Muth.
Through the chair and Representative Reinbold, we certainly are in a fiscal crisis, and I fully support the legislature's efforts in trying to solve those budget concerns. There's, you know, there's definitely different things that the legislature is considering and all of that. When I came in and I looked at the budget, and many of you have been in the subcommittee process, but I know the public and those watching haven't participated with us in that process. But the big picture is that the Department of Law over the last 4 years has taken significant cuts. It was 23% since 2014 and 28% since FY 2012. And we've really lost a lot of our positions in the department. And coming in and looking at this with fresh eyes and having with my management experience in private practice at Dorsey & Whitney, you know, I was able to come in and meet with all of the different sections that that my folks, you know, that we do. So I'm meeting with folks in groups of 5 to 20 people at a time to really understand what we're doing and what services we're providing and whether we're providing the best services to the state. And looking at where we're at budget-wise, I really have decided and really believe that we've cut too far and cut through the fat, and we're down into bone. And so we're really to the point where we're impacting core services. And again, those core services are criminal prosecutions, child protection, and then state sovereignty and pursuing state rights, both in fighting for state sovereignty issues with the federal government and in collecting tax and other types of revenues for the state. And so our general fund dollars, that's where the three main buckets are focused. What as part of the governor's a budget this year, what we recommended to the governor and then recommended to this legislature is a fairly flat budget. I mean, recognizing that times are tough, we our goal was just to stay even and not to suffer further cuts as we move forward. And so that's what we were advocating as far as our part of the fiscal certainty and first fiscal budget. if this, if the legislature does achieve fiscal certainty and that those pieces of the pie are put together or how the state's going to move forward into the future fiscally, I do think that it's something that I'd like to do is revisit the Department of Law's budget and look at what's the best for the state, both looking at the cost-benefit analysis on public safety issues and the cost-benefit analysis on pursuing other types of state resources.
Further questions,
Representative? Can I continue, or are we going to go around? Because I have a couple more.
Why don't you go ahead and finish your questions, and then we'll let somebody else have
Okay, time. Excellent. Thank you. I do appreciate it. Okay, so the bottom line is, as you know, you've heard this over and over, just in agency operations, just in agency operations, UGF, DGF, other, and federal funds, we're spending $7.5 billion, which, according to Kaiser Foundation, is about three times the national average. If you back out the permanent fund and you look at the U.S. Census data, it's about 2.5 times, and that's the average, okay? So, and even according to your staff's figures, just since 2008, your department has gone up 40% with the state has gone down roughly in the last 10 years from $10 billion down to $1 billion in regards to revenues. I know that's generalizing, but bottom line is I need not only hold the line, I really need you to help us reduce the budget. So with that, the closing, you know, a lot of businesses are closing their doors. They're laying people off. I believe Senator Murkowski said today, not only are we in a recession, but we're the number one, I believe she said, for unemployment. It's huge. So the decisions you make do impact the private sector and whether it's a friendly place to do business here. And I'm just going to ask you, will you consider the impacts to the private sector and the economy when you guys make decisions?
Through the chair, you know, I view my role as the Attorney General and as for the top attorney for the entire state is to really look at all Alaskans and the what's the best for the state as a whole. And I think we need to keep making those kind of legal decisions with that in mind. I don't want to focus just on the private sector or on public sector. The way I view my role is to be the attorney for all Alaskans.
And Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what you basically answered my next question. What I was going to do, you represent the governor? Do you represent the state? Do you represent your department? What specifically do you see your role as an attorney general? What's the most important thing that you do?
Through the chair, there's a couple of different questions in there, Representative Reinbold. And the way I've been breaking out what my role is as Attorney General is it really kind of falls into three buckets. And so, you know, as the head of the Department of Law, and we currently have 455 filled positions, so I'm managing the largest law firm in the state of Alaska. So we have almost 300 attorneys and the rest, you know, paralegals and staff to support those. And that's certainly an important role, part of the role of as Attorney General. The second role is the top lawyer for the state, and so I'm involved in the major legal decisions that the state is making. And I certainly have great attorneys that are helping me do that and with expertise in various issues. But as we decide whether to take a course of action or if we're going to initiate litigation, if we're going to settle a big case, those are all things that rise up to my level. And so my staff will brief me, and we will usually collectively come to a decision, but when it comes down to it, the buck stops here, and I have to be the one that's responsible for making those legal decisions. And then the third role of Attorney General is as a cabinet member, and so part of the governor's cabinet, and certainly there to help advise and guide the governor and administration. And I do think it's important to have a lawyer on the cabinet and help advise on the legal issues that the state's facing at that high policy level. I don't know, the next part of your question was what's most important, and all of those things are important. I think everything that I do and all of those roles that I take are very important, and I certainly realize the seriousness and the import of the Attorney General's role in all of those things for all of Alaskans.
Any further follow-up?
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I think this is just a very, very important process, okay? And I've had the pleasure of helping get through the process of another attorney general. I ask very similar questions of him. But Basically, I would love to go through what do you think about right to life? What do you think about gay marriage? What will you do if, you know, an opinion comes out from the courts versus when you swear to uphold and defend, not only uphold, but defend the Constitution of Alaska for right to life issues for a marriage between one man and one woman? I know some lawyer, you know, federal, you know, basically decided to overrule us and our Constitution, but I swear to uphold our Constitution. So I guess what my question to you is going to be, when push comes to shove, there's lots of lawyers that throw out their opinions at whatever court case it happens to be. Where are you going to lean? Are you going to lean to defend and uphold our Constitution, or are you going to yield to an opinion of a lawyer?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I think you're getting at a very important issue, which is that the role of this top state attorney and advising the state is to really focus on what the law is, what the rule of law on any particular issue is. And, of course, you're right that the Alaska Constitution, the federal Constitution, are the most important guiding principles in that. And then there's the statutes that this legislature passes and the rest of that. And so on any particular issue, I think the most important thing is to follow the law and to uphold that rule of law. And my particular opinion on any particular issue really doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, I need to be following the law on any particular issue.
Further follow-up?
Just a follow-up. So, as the Constitution clearly states, it is the supreme law of the land, and we do swear, you do swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States and the state of Alaska, and that will be your tallest order. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's right. That's the oath that I took and that I take very seriously.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman has question, comments?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. These should be questions. We can have comments after that.
Absolutely. I'll start off by saying I haven't decided yet whether or not to forward this nomination to the body, and that's what we're here for, and that's what these questions are for. So I don't have any comments yet, but I'm sure that there'll be a time for that. So let's start with something that we can agree on. So you represent in some manner the executive branch, because you fall in the executive branch. But of course you're here today because you don't serve just the executive branch. To a certain extent, you know, you are part of the interplay between all three branches. So if one of those branches, and let's just pick the judiciary for example, is overstepping its bounds and is usurping the legislature's authority by legislating from the bench, how do you see your role as an attorney general in that type of a situation?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, you know, I think that there are certainly issues where the Attorney General needs to step in where the Constitution is being violated or if there's any particular issues. And again, you know, I represent the entire state, and you're right, often that's the administrative executive branch. There are times where we do represent the court system. If they're sued on a particular matter, the Attorney General's office can be involved in defending and representing the court system. They also have their own attorneys that advise them on particular issues. The same is true with the legislative branch. So there's alleged legal that helps, that represents the legislative branch, but there may be times where the Attorney General's office becomes involved and also may be involved in any representation of a particular matter. So that all comes to play. So the example that you gave of, you know, one particular judicial officer kind of legislating from the bench, and I know that's a concern of many folks, is you know, sort of the judicial activist type judge. And that's really an issue that it needs to be dealt with in the court system first, as far as, you know, if there's a superior court judge that makes a decision that doesn't follow the rule of law and is implementing policy, then that's why we have appellate courts in place to help review that and to address those concerns. Now, if at the end of a particular court case and the Supreme Court's has decided what the law is, and you know the Supreme Court's there to help interpret the law, including the Constitution and those principles. If the legislative branch feels that doesn't reflect the law that they enacted or that the Constitution reflects, then the legislature has the ability to enact policy, additional laws and statutes that would address the policy concerns that they see in any particular case.
So in the scenario that I laid out, where you do have the one branch, the judiciary branch, which has overstepped its bounds, as an attorney, one might expect you to give a certain amount of deference to the state Supreme Court on any number of issues. As an attorney general, do you give that same deference, or do you have a way by which you question the appropriateness of a Supreme Court decision? As an attorney general, are there things that you would do as attorney general when you believe that a Alaska Supreme Court decision was decided improperly?
Through the chair, obviously the Attorney General's office and through the Department of Law participates in many court cases that are heard in our court system. And we are also, whether we're a party or not, if there's any constitutional issues that are raised in a court case, then the Department of Law is notified of that so that we have the ability to weigh in on any particular, the constitutionality of any particular statute. And so those are things that we do monitor and do participate in those types of cases through the court system. If the Alaska Supreme Court decides a case that we disagree with and there are issues of federal constitutional law, then those are things that we can decide to appeal to the United States Supreme Court. So there's that route if you disagree with an Alaska Supreme Court decision. But again, if the Alaska Supreme Court, as the interpreter of Alaska law and the final arbiter of that, they do have, that's part of the purview of how the constitutional system works, that branch of government interprets the law, then we have to defer to them. And then, again, it comes back to the legislature. If they disagree with the policy issues that were addressed in any particular case, then the legislature can change the policy.
So I take that to mean that once the Supreme Courts make a decision, that you will defer to that judgment.
Through the chair, if it's on an issue of an Alaska constitutional issue or an Alaska law, then I think they are the final arbiter of interpreting that law. And then if it's a federal constitutional issue, it's something that the United States Supreme Court could be the final arbiter.
Any other questions? Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General, it's been really good to get to know you through a few visits, and you certainly have the demeanor, I think, that we're looking for. But now for harder questions. One of the things that this legislature has struggled with over the years, and it usually depends on who the governor is whether or not to pass legislation separating out the Attorney General's office, from the executive branch or not. And you'll see it kind of, depending on who the governor is, you can kind of tell who's going to file the bill. I've seen it go, both ways, but overall there has been an interest over decades. And my observation has been it is because the legislature gets frustrated when they pass legislation, and then they deem maybe the executive branch doesn't want to go to bat to support the legislation that they lawfully passed. And so that's where you got to get put in the hot seat. And as an observation, we appreciated, and I say we, not all of us here, but we who support the whole definition of marriage as being between a man and a woman, the fact that Attorney General Richards filed an amicus brief and Governor Walker let him do it. He said, I'm staying out of it. He can file a brief supporting the state's position on this issue, which was in our Constitution. And regardless of how all that plays out, it gives the people of Alaska confidence when they see the AG looking at, okay, what have the people passed? And I'm going to argue it, regardless of how you feel, maybe personally. But you say, I'm going to argue it. I'm going to go to bat for them. This is what the people in full legislative body assembled passed. And so I anticipate you will face situations you know, where you are going to be on the hot seat of saying, do I advocate for what this body has passed, or do I not? And there can be a lot of political pressure by particular groups to do something or not do something. And so my question would be, do you have a philosophy of your role in those type of situations and how you would approach those things?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I've been in this position 6 months, and I think that gives me some experience to speak from now that I may not have had if I were only a month into this. And I really do appreciate the role that the Department of Law plays in how legislation moves through the legislature. And we try to weigh in early when there's concerns that are raised, whether, you know, somebody's proposing something that may be unconstitutional or raise concerns. And so we try to address those in the process itself, so that when we get to the end and the Department of Law has to write a letter to the governor about the particular legislation that's passed and whether the governor should sign it, that we can say it is constitutional and it's something that we have no concerns with at law.
Right.
And there's that process is in place so that, you know, the legislature does pass constitutional laws. And I really do fully appreciate that I think that works, and it's a functional system. And so once a law has passed and it's had that kind of review and, you know, that kind of, you know, the governor has signed off on it and the department has looked at it and said this is, you know, we don't have concerns with the constitutionality, and there's a lawsuit down the road, we certainly should be defending the constitutionality of any validly passed legislation that reflects a policy decision by this legislature, even if it's something that, you know, personally I have issues with or would have decided differently. Mm-hmm. My role as the Attorney General is to defend the constitutionality of any validly passed legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Everyone follow up. So thank you for that, Attorney General. So follow-up question. We recently had our state Supreme Court struck down the parental notification initiative 4-1. And I'm one of those people that strongly agrees with Chief Justice Storr's dissent. You know, he basically said we've told the people of Alaska that there is no way they can pass any pro-life legislation protecting the unborn. That's the one-sentence summation of his entire dissent. That's a little bit discouraging to this legislative body. And, you know, when we look at how the court rules sometimes you can see, and I am definitely not a reactionary person. I like to take the long view on almost everything, but that is why some people start wanting to look at, well, how do we, you know, look at the whole system of how we can get people in the judiciary who are willing to overrule an elected assembly. And if by some miracle a constitutionally passable bill that protected the lives of the unborn was passed, and it would be challenged immediately by those entities that challenge those, do you feel like you could again advocate for a law that was passed? And I'm picking subjects that are of extreme emotional or charged or politically charged debate, just because I want to, what I'm driving at is, are you comfortable supporting a law that is passed by this legislature and arguing for the merits of it in front of a court?
Absolutely. That's what we're here for. I mean, there's a rule of law, and if it's, and part of your premise was that, I mean, even though it may be difficult and with this court, if there's a defense that it's constitutional, that's the role of the Attorney General, is to defend the constitutionality of that statute.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ledoux.
Is the role of the Attorney General to represent the governor or to represent the people? I mean, I've always kind of supported the idea of an elected attorney general, because that makes it clear that the attorney general's client is the you know, the electorate. But that's not what we have right now. And I've always thought that the Attorney General, or that the governor calls the shots as to what the Attorney General, what positions the Attorney General takes. But when we had the confirmation hearings for Craig Richards, he thought differently. So what's your philosophy on that? And how would you deal with something that you thought was a winnable case and that you should take for the people of the state of Alaska, and the governor thought differently? Who's your obligation to?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, those two things I don't tie together in my mind. So just because in Alaska the Attorney General is appointed by the governor and serves at the pleasure of the governor, I don't think of the governor as my client. I mean, I think that the state is my client, the people of the state are my client. That often comes out that I wear different hats and I represent different clients who are representing the people, so that, you know, all of the different departments of the state, the different boards, the Board of Game, for example, is, you know, a client of the Department of Law. And oftentimes there could even be conflicts between those clients. So Department of Natural Resources and Department of Transportation may look at something differently, whether there's an easement through a property, I mean, just for example. And so we have to have different attorneys appointed. And so the Attorney General wears different hats in that, in representing the state as a whole and its people. The governor is just one of those clients. Now, he is the top elected official, and as such, and with the vote of those people, he does at the end make the final policy call when there's policy calls to be made, I think. So if there's, you know, as that works the way through. But as far as the making the call on the law and what the law is, that's the role of the Attorney General. And so, and again, it's sort of a traditional framework in how I approach this job is after 20 years in private practice as advising clients and giving a framework of here's the legal framework of this particular issue, and here's your range of policy calls that can be made. Since I'm not elected, and there are people who are elected, the policy call with any particular issue should be made by elected officials in a sense. But again, there's instances where there aren't policy calls to be made, and that the Attorney General actually is a more direct representative of the people. So, say, in the regulatory affairs world with Regulatory Commission of Alaska, we are, by statute and by definition, we are representing the people in those proceedings. And so, and any particular issue, you have to look at who's your client and how do we, you know, who's the final decision maker on any particular issue. Again, if it's the constitutionality of a statute, again, that again falls directly in the purview of the Attorney General's office, I think, to make that call, because it's, even if it's something that the governor's office may not want to pursue and defend the constitutionality, it's a validly passed legislation, and again, that needs to be pursued in defense of that statute. So it's a complicated issue, and but it's something that I think that my role and my experience in private practice has led me to help understand those issues. So one of the subspecialties that I've had in my career is fiduciary duty cases. So I've had a bunch of different corporate governance type cases where a board has been challenged, an executive officer has been challenged, there's been fraud cases, and so there's issues of self-dealing on any particular person or board who have been deemed to represent the people. They're supposed to be representing their shareholders in corporate governance cases. And as a lawyer, you need to come in and advise that, no, you've acted outside of your fiduciary duties and those kind of things. And so as the Attorney General, you do need to keep those things in mind and make sure the different representatives of the states are obeying their fiduciary duties as I advise the state and its different representatives.
Any follow-up, Representative Ledoux? Representative Eastman, you had to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier this morning on the chair, the topic of immigration and sanctuary cities came up. Now, I don't know any of your personal views on immigration or our nation's laws, but on that topic, since there is some controversy, as Attorney General, can you decline to enforce laws that you disagree with without violating your oath?
Through the chair, that is a complicated question, and I think you need more context in order to answer the particulars of that. I believe you're referring to Senator Murkowski's comments to the legislature this morning, and there was questions asked about an administrative order that came out from the Trump administration yesterday. When I heard that, I was listening in on the live feed on that. I immediately asked my folks to look at that and to evaluate whether there's something there that we need to, as a state, evaluate whether that comports with the law and that, what the state's going to be asked to do and whether that is legal. And I just don't know the answer to that yet. I think it's something that in any particular, especially when you're looking at directives from the federal government, that we really need to pay close attention to whether it's something that falls within the purview of the federal constitution, the state constitution, and the framework that we're given, so that we can decide as a state whether we object to that prerogative or not. And I just don't know what the final answer of that's going to be.
Follow-up to the chair?
Follow-up, yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then let me give you a more detailed scenario. So if it came to your attention that there was a law requiring a governor to, say, present a balanced budget to the legislature, and the governor had declined to do so, what would you do as Attorney General in that type of situation? How would you approach the tension between your understanding of what a law requires and your observation that an executive, in this case a governor, was not in compliance?
Through the chair, I do think that's one of the positives of having the system that we have, of having the Attorney General be part of the governor's cabinet and be part of the close advisory group of the governor, in that we can address these concerns early on and part of a privileged conversation of, governor, I think that these are issues that you need to address, and that, my advice as the top lawyer would be to, X, Y, or Z, whatever the issue may be. And so you address those concerns early on, and I think it's actually a good process to have that kind of top legal advice available for the administration as they work through these issues, and I think that you'll run into less problems going forward. Now, the flip side of that is, most other states do have elected attorney generals, and when I met some recently, I met one fellow who in the 2 years of his tenure had already sued his governor four times, and I don't think that's a very functional system to have that type of thing happen, and that's not maybe the best way to address those concerns. And so I think that the soft advice behind the scenes is sort of the best way to keep the administration on task and within the rule of law.
And is there a
follow-up?
Yes, thank you. Is there a responsibility the Attorney General would have in the case that you view the law to say a certain thing, and your advice is not heeded, and the executive decides to not conform behavior to a statute, or should you wait for someone else to raise that kind of issue?
Through the chair, it's really hard to imagine where that would come up or how that would present itself, and I think in any particular, it would be a very difficult situation no matter what. And I think you'd have to evaluate what your options were at the time and how best to address it. And I really can't prejudge how that would be, but it's certainly something that I would take seriously if I thought that the governor were going down a road that I thought was contrary to law.
Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, going back to the idea of whether or not the state had any obligation to enforce federal laws, I thought in the context, and I mean where it first came up, is the marijuana legislation. I mean, if attorney generals had an obligation to support federal laws, then the laws of probably more than half of the states right now would have to be challenged and ignored by their attorney generals. And I thought that there was a line of either federal, I think federal law, which talks about you can't do something that the federal government can't obligate you or a state to enforce a federal law. I mean, it can say, hey, if you don't do it, you're not going to get any money. But kind of a separation of powers argument that it just didn't, that it wasn't unconstitutional to pass legislation which was in violation of federal law because the one sovereign couldn't force another sovereign to do something. Am I right there? Or
Through the chair, I think that is a principle, but it may not apply in every circumstance. And so you really need to evaluate any particular issue and decide whether the federal law would control or if there's a way in that particular instance that the state could be mandated to do something. And so it's just really, it's a complicated area of the law that we're currently evaluating, and I don't have the final answer on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cobb. I think you were representing.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Do you want to be in the queue, Representative Reinbold?
Absolutely. Reinbold?
Okay.
on this note, Mr. Chairman, I think our legislature, we actually passed maybe one or two laws directing the Attorney General to not enforce a federal law, maybe that would further restrict firearms ownership. My memory may be faulty, but was that right, Representative Ledoux? Didn't we pass something like that?
I'm not sure that the entire legislature passed it, but I know that the House passed
The House passed it, okay. So it's not unheard of for this body to be fairly prescriptive at times. And so it could be something that you might be faced with. Maybe we haven't successfully got it out of here, but certainly is a discussion point in the halls.
I think if I could just...
Go ahead, Representative Ledoux.
I think that the law that we passed, or at least we know that the House passed, obligated the state to arrest federal agents if they started to, that they did something in violation of our gun laws.
Mm-hmm. That's gun rights is actually a fairly, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, yeah, gun rights is actually a fairly nonpartisan issue in this state. So.
Yeah. All right. I'm not sure that calls for any response from the Attorney General Lindemuth. Representative Reinbold, you had one more question.
It's actually, I'm going to go a little bit philosophy and then, with the indulgence of the chair, two questions. But
can we actually stick to the questions and then you can go to philosophy during comments? How about that?
Sure.
Okay.
I can do that. Okay, so the question to you is, do you see your role as Attorney General as shaping or enforcing policy? And the reason I ask is I believe you're on the Criminal Justice Commission, and I believe that those guys weighed in, and I know there's disagreement on this committee, but that's normal. But the bottom line is they gave very specific recommendations that I found appalling in regards to public safety, which I believe public safety is our absolute most important mandate. I was shocked at what the commission came up with. And I also think there's a severe separation of powers issue with judges and executive branch weighing in on law. We only get to do two things here, write the law and budgets. And I believe that was completely invaded with judges and the executive branch weighing in on policy. I really do believe that there needs to be a much bigger separation in this body of the legislature versus the executive branch versus the judicial branch. But the bottom line, what do you see your role? Do you see it as shaping or enforcing both or neither?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I see my primary role as enforcing the law as currently written, and that there would be still a small policy role involved in that, especially since I'm a commissioner on the Alaska Justice Criminal Justice Commission. So as a commissioner, that's a subset of the role of Attorney General, where there's certainly policy issues that we address on the commission. And to follow on then, when there are legal issues or legal changes to the law, that especially the Department of Law is recommending, including amendments that we'd like to see to the SB 91 criminal justice reform. We certainly are, that's certainly a policy issue that we're advocating for, and so that is, that there's a small policy role there. But the primary role, I think, as Attorney General is to enforce and to make sure that the laws of the state of Alaska are complied with and followed.
So any other questions?
Follow up to that. Because some people looked at these recommendations from the Justice Commission, you know, as gospel, where I looked at them as a horror book. I mean, I could not believe what came out of them, what comes out of some, at least some of the original. And so I guess to me, I would ask you to step back and look, is there a separation of powers issue, which I believe there's a huge, because a lot of my colleagues ended up looking at that more as gospel, where I looked at it, and some other some Democrats, such as Andy Josephson, also looked at it more as a horror show, you know, with what some of the things. So I guess what I'm asking you is, will you please look at the other side, and as you have done, and I have respect for you that you have done, listen, not only listen, but help us make this law better and keep in mind the victims, and maybe that we went too far with this policy, but if you would please just help us as government, as public safety. Do you see public safety as being one of the most important mandates in law, as your role?
Through the chair, public safety is one of the top priorities of the Department of Law, and I think of the administration of Governor Walker's administration. But again, the way laws are prosecuted in the state of Alaska, the Department of Law has primary prosecutorial responsibility, and so we are responsible for public safety. We are, you know, a huge component of making sure that the public is safe. To return to your original question, you know, I think that the legislature has the sole power on legislation. So really, that's not something that that should be deferred to other areas. The commission certainly made recommendations, and I think that the legislature then needs to take those recommendations and decide what's best for the state, looking at all of the policy issues. And I think that the commission's recommendations are certainly helpful. The recent recommendations that came out for the amendments to SB 91 don't go far enough in Department of Law's viewpoint. So both Department of Law and Department of Public Safety, with the support of the governor, are advocating for additional changes to the laws that aren't reflected or go further than what the commission is recommending.
Can I ask the second question?
Follow up. Go ahead.
Well, this is a different question. I would just ask that it's a heartfelt public safety, not just a lot of, there's a lot more victims, a lot more crime, a lot going out there, but I'm not going to get into that right now. The bottom line is, would you support the Attorney General being elected so you truly represent the people of Alaska and have to go through the intense vetting process? Would you support a policy such as that?
Through the chair, having looked at this and I understand that most other states actually have elected attorney general positions, I think that this state was sort of blessed in a way of being one of the last states to the union and having a constitutional convention that happened where those delegates could evaluate how every other state did everything. And I think those delegates took long and hard in looking at how our state is put together, and that taking sort of the politics out of the Department of Law, I think is actually a good thing. And so to have an elected AG, you're really having a fourth branch of government in effect, you know, in a sense where, and you add money and politics into the top lawyer's position, it just really complicates matters of, you know, then your question is, are corporations who gave money to the campaign, are they being treated better in both, you know, regulatory issues and in criminal prosecution issues and those kind of things? So there's definitely pluses and minuses to both systems. But I do think, if you're looking at my personal opinion on this particular issue, I actually think that we got it right in Alaska and that it's best to have it be an appointed position.
Can I make a comment on that issue, on that point?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so the bottom line is I don't necessarily think that it's politics. I think it's the people and the people's vote. and the people rallying and vetting for who they want to be, you know, in that position. So I actually think it's a decent idea that needs to be looked at. And also companies don't vote, people vote. And I think we could do a no financial contribution or whatever, or have tight restrictions like we all have, you know, on our campaigns with low limitations. But I do believe that it's really important for the people to know their attorney general and who their attorney general is. And with that, I'm thankful for this process, but I'm still going to ask later for a philosophy point. But
philosophy moment. We'll take that up after. We're just trying to get questions for the attorney general. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the Attorney General, you are the chief law enforcement official for our state. No easy job. And I want to know, will you permit law enforcement, whom, as chief law enforcement, you represent that community in many respects, will you permit law enforcement to break the law in order to enforce it? If you will, I suppose that's easy enough to answer. If you won't, what tools would you consider using to prevent that taking place?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't believe that law enforcement can or does break the law in enforcing the law. So I think I don't think it's an issue that we need to address. If you have any particular officer who's breaking the law, I think that you just need to deal with that, and there's legal processes in place to do that.
Any other questions? I think we've... No, not quite. Go ahead, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Resource and resource protection issues are a big deal, and I know you know that. Our Supreme Court has ruled that you can't manage a fishery from the ballot box. Are you comfortable defending that position?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I'm not familiar with the court case.
No, that's okay. I'll explain further. We recently had a ballot initiative that would preclude set netting in Cook Inlet. So that group of fishermen that harvest fish in that way would be prohibited. And our Supreme Court said, no, you're not going to manage that way. And are you, there's a lot of politics, you think, I mean, there's a lot of politics in fish in Alaska. And do you feel strong enough to engage on that issue? Our Supreme Court has ruled, and are you good on that opinion?
Through the chair, again, you're returning sort of to the theme that we heard before. If the Alaska Supreme Court has spoken on an issue of Alaska law, and I understand the issue is whether it can be done, whether some action can be taken by ballot initiative, or whether a statute needs to be passed by the legislature in order to address some particular policy issue, then I think we need to defer to the Alaska Supreme Court on that particular issue. I fully agree, and that's one of the surprising issues that when I took this job of how important fish and wildlife issues are in Alaska, and how many legal issues are involved in that particular endeavor. I mean, we have at least one person who's fully dedicated to that at the Department of Law and representing the Department of Fish and Game and those issues. And, you know, I spoke with the Board of Game just last week and went up and presented to them and spoke with them. So it's certainly an important issue for all of Alaska. You know, we have a constitutional provision that addresses natural resources and fish and wildlife in Alaska, and it's important to maintain those principles and defend those principles. I also presented to Senate Resources, was it last week? It seems like 2 weeks ago already. The time is like coming quickly. But again, we covered all of the federal issues that are facing the state, and there were a handful of fish and wildlife cases that the department is handling, including filing litigation in early January against the federal government, both for the National Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife regulations that impacted the state's ability to manage its resources. So those are certainly issues that are top and forefront in the Department of Law's agenda and looking at those cases.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is what I'm going to ask, because we're running out of time, and I'd like to get one bill through today. We're going to go around one last time. And this is the last time you get to ask questions, because I think we're actually starting to retread a lot of the same ground. You're asking a lot of the same questions, just trying to ask it a little differently, and the answer is pretty much the same. And so I'm not I want to move this along, and I think we've had it. So this is, you can ask as many as you want now, but you don't get
round. Fortunate for us all, I only have one question that I'm desiring to ask at the moment, and that deals with our state constitution. Our state constitution, Article 9, Section 13, spells out that no money shall be withdrawn from the Treasury except in accordance with appropriations made by law. And there have been occasions in recent years where our state Supreme Court has endeavored to direct the legislature to fund programs that the legislature has not chosen to fund. So considering that the Constitution gives the authority to make expenditures exclusively to the legislative body, the branch, how can the courts be corrected from overstepping and impinging upon a responsibility solely given to another body of government?
Through the chair, I'm not familiar with what particular court cases you're referring to, but again, the constitutional principle that the legislature has the power of appropriation is fundamental. I mean, that's one of those starting spots. And so that's one of those issues, as Department of Law attorneys are briefing constitutional issues, that our folks do keep in mind and are constant or are aware of the constitutional provisions that govern. And so part of the process, I think, is just making sure that issues are properly briefed to the court, whether it's the Superior Court or the Supreme Court, and to make sure that we have good, strong constitutional analysis that makes sure that our courts make the right final decision on the end on those particular issues. But again, that's an important, an issue that you're right that it comes up again as far as the courts at least pointing out that there's an unfunded mandate potentially on any particular issue of a statute saying one thing and then not providing the money to do so without appropriation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopp, any last questions? Representative Christ-Tompkins, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Attorney General. So I have a question about, I guess, the different branches of government and relating to your perspective on how they interrelate. And as Representative Reinbold aptly noted, you are the chief attorney in Alaska's largest law firm, effectively, and you have a lot of clients. And there's a lot of expertise in the Department of Law, expertise that can't be found anywhere else. And so my question is, occasionally with particularly complex pieces of legislation, especially constitutionally complex pieces of legislation, there's expertise that resides in the Department of Law that can't really be ably found elsewhere, including in legislative legal to some extent. And I was wondering if you could speak to your perspective on what is appropriate and inappropriate to the nature of collaboration between the two branches, and in good faith or otherwise, advising or offering perspective on crafting legislation and working with the legislative branch.
Through the chair, Representative, that's definitely something that we do on a daily basis. And so the legislature has Leg Legal and they have their own counsel, but we assign, at the Department of Law, we assign an attorney to each bill that's going through the House. And so that person is available to offer legal analysis and comment as we move through that process. What we don't want to have happen is we get to the end of the process and a bill gets passed that the Department of Law is saying, hey, wait a second, that was unconstitutional or whatever, there's a problem here. We want to raise those issues early and flag those issues early so that the legislative process works as efficiently and effectively as possible. And certainly if there's any particular legislation that any particular legislator has a question of, we're certainly happy to be involved early. And I tried to make that known as I met with different legislators, as sitting down with folks at the beginning of the session, that we are certainly open and available to answer any particular questions and give our thoughts early on in the process so we weigh in and have good product at the end.
Thank you.
Representative Fanzler, any questions?
No.
Representative Ledoux. Representative Reinbold, last chance.
Thank you. So I've got two quick questions. I think they're pretty easy to answer. I know you've probably, and then I'd like to make the final comment, but the past president, I'm sure you probably were able to work with him, and I'm asking that with this new president, do you believe that you will be able to work with him?
Through the chair, I think working with any administration, federal administration, is an important part of this job, and so, you know, there are going to be issues where we disagree with this incoming administration. There were issues that we disagreed with the past administration. I think you have to have open dialogue on those particular issues, and I certainly have a philosophy that you need to address things early on and have a fruitful discussion when there's an issue of disagreement, and so that you're not ending up in litigation down the road, and we can avoid that. We certainly saw the need. The state has had the need to litigate various issues over the last recent years, and I'd hope that we can avoid that. I'm actually hopeful that this incoming administration will be more favorable to Alaska on many of the natural resource and those type of issues that the state's been in litigation with over recent years. And so I'm excited to see what we can do.
Okay, so with that, you know.
Follow on.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, I just really want to encourage you to try to work with this administration. And I also would ask you, this is a quick question, and I believe I know the answer to this, but I'm asking you to try to purge political leanings out of your department. I mean, I've definitely got complaints in my district, and people are calling me pretty regularly about concerns that they have in your department. I even have a couple lawyers that are concerned, and staff, about some – it's kind of hostile for some conservatives in the Department of Law. So I guess what I'm asking is if you would please try to help make it a safe work environment for all political viewpoints in the department. I know it's a tall order, but I'm going to ask that of you, and I believe that you are, if anybody, would be capable of doing that. And you can feel free to answer that, but then I'd like to make my final statement.
Through the chair, I'm unaware of any particular issues of folks not feeling safe at the Department of Law, and it would really concern me if that were true. But I am definitely committed to having a safe workplace and having folks feel like their views are respected, and that's something that I am definitely committed to. My personal view on how I operate is I want to hear all viewpoints and issues and really have things fully vetted from my folks, from all of the different thoughts that people might answer or have before I actually make a final decision. And so I fully support that.
Okay, and I appreciate that.
So we'll go to comments after she finishes.
Okay.
You'll get a chance to make your comment.
This was in regards to that.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. It's a follow-up
to
that question. Sure. That's fine.
In regards to this, well, I do know someone from my district that recently quit, and I know someone who feels like it is a hostile environment for their opinions. And so it is an issue, and I'm just asking you to be aware of it. It's hard for me to bring up on record this, but it's come to me too many times for me not to say something. So I'm just asking, you know, as Attorney General, to please watch for that and make it for all, you know, political views to be respected in your department. Thank you.
Certainly.
Thank you. That's all the questions, so thank you very much for joining us today. I do note, I see on the board, I see Ken Jacobus has signed in, and I'm not clear because he was also signed. He's not in. Okay. So he's not there for testimony on this. So I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on this. And this is an opportunity if members of the committee would like to make comments. And again, what we'll do is, rather than I think we've vetted a lot of discussion, I don't think, unless there's a real need to have a lot of back and forth, I'll just go around the room. Everyone can make comments as they see fit, and then we'll go on to the next step. And Representative Reinbold, you're ready, so I'll let you start.
I am ready, and I do appreciate this. I do think this is one of the most important appointments in the state, and I thank you that we've gotten over an hour to do this. I think it's worthy of the time. But I would like to make a comment at a very high level that I believe one of the most progressive ideals of all time in the history of the world is the inalienable rights that were given Americans, each and every American citizen. Inalienable rights, they're God-given inalienable rights. Some of the modern progressives are progressing us far away from the most progressive ideals of all time, and they're infringing on the right to life and on the right to for many liberties. So I'm asking you to not look to the modern, you know, progressives for wisdom. I'm asking you to please always be grounded that the role is public safety. You know, our most important mandate is public safety and protection of these inalienable rights. That's why America has been so successful over the years, in particular the right to life, you know, the right to pursuit of happiness and the liberties that we enjoy with our amendments. And I'm also going to ask you that you please keep in mind, also part of our Constitution is the ability to enjoy the fruits of our labor. There's some people working and there's some people not. Some people that are not working are enjoying the fruits of the labor of those that are. And I believe it's very constitutional that you keep that at heart, that the people who are working, let them enjoy the fruits of their labor. I'm also going to ask you to please also not necessarily look to lawyers, you know, for your wisdom and insight. I'm going to ask you to look back to our founding fathers and some of the principles that made America so wonderful and one of the freest, most prosperous nations in the world. And there's amazing wisdom that I find. I look back to the founding fathers all the time for my wisdom. I don't necessarily look to the people of today for wisdom. I look back there, and I'm just going to ask you as Attorney General to please do that. And with that, I thank you so much for serving and going through this process, and I do wish you well.
Representative Ledoux.
Nothing.
Representative Fanstaff. Representative Christ Tompkins.
I just want to say thank you for being willing to serve, and especially given the circumstances of the transition. I think it's a decision a lot of people who run for the legislature encounter, which is the opportunity cost of public service can be significant in ways financial and otherwise, and it would seem that that might be the case with your transition professionally as well. And so I wanted to note gratitude for your willingness. And on a personal and philosophical note, I appreciated your answer on the relation of the Attorney General relative to the governor. And that's a perspective I've held regardless of administration, including the administration prior to this one. And I wryly note that in many other states, AG often is speculated to stand for aspiring governor. In fact, I think in the state of Virginia, where there's a term limit of one term, the last three or four gubernatorial candidates from the respective parties have been, in fact, the incumbent AG, and it just seems messy. And so I just appreciate this sort of more non-political nature of the office and have a lot of confidence that you'll be able to continue that tradition in Alaska.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Attorney General, for being willing to do this job. Your two predecessors paid a very high price, nearly worked themselves to death, in my opinion. And so I don't know what you're going to have to do to manage it, but it is I'm very delighted you're willing to step into that gap, which I know is at great personal sacrifice, and thank you for that. Your department has been through a lot, and in fact, one of your attorneys was killed in Utqavik, Brian, I think was his name, 3 years ago. And they have a tough job in tough villages and remote spots, and they need a good leader, and we're counting on you to be that person, and I believe you have a good heart for people. And I would just close with saying I'm very appreciative of you being willing to do this.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, remembering the death of Assistant ADA Brian Sullivan is very personal to me. I worked directly for Brian when I was in the Army on Fort Richardson. He was one of the folks who actually was encouraging me to go to law school and become a lawyer and actually get involved in politics, because he had been a former state legislator himself. And I would ask our Attorney General to review the oath of office that you took as Attorney General. And my perspective on these things might be different than some others, but I also know it closely reflects the perspective of my district. And as a captain in our United States Armed Forces. My oath was to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and to bear true faith and allegiance to the same. And I was required to question the orders of those appointed over me, even in a military setting, to ascertain if my allegiance to the Constitution was in conflict with any orders I was given, either in Afghanistan or anywhere else. And even in that military setting, that expectation was still very strong, and there was no question that if I obeyed an unconstitutional order, that no matter what happened to my commanding officers, that would fall on me personally. And so we had a saying at West Point, if you are willing to die for your country, it's assumed that you would be willing to be fired for it. And I appreciate the indulgence of the chairman in asking a few different questions, which of course were similar, which were to, I think, the defining issue for me in this decision of approving a confirmation, is the balance of powers between the three branches, and specifically, what does it mean for an attorney general to take an oath, which, since I just want to make sure I have it correct out of the state constitution, was I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Alaska. And I think what I heard in answers to various questions that we had earlier was that there's sort of an unwritten statement in that oath, and that unwritten statement might take the form of Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Alaska as interpreted by the Alaska Supreme Court. And I do not believe that language appears in that oath. I think it was very deliberately left out when our nation's founders were deliberating on checks between various branches of government. There was not a desire that the Supreme Court was the final arbiter of your or my responsibilities as public officials. As a lawyer trying a case, it's kind of a different situation, I think. And I go back to the last election. On election day, my district was so dissatisfied with the judges in our state that my district voted down every single judge. The voters in my district took the time, which is amazing to me in some respects, took the time to individually mark no to every single judge. And there was over 20 on the ballot in my district. And that reflects a level of dissatisfaction with tension between the branches of government, tensions between the ability of the people through a referendum, through a ballot measure to pass a law. In this case, we're talking about parental notification. They feel that has been denied them by a judiciary that does not represent them well, does not, in every case, act in the best interests of our state. And part of that might be the process by which individuals are selected for that service on the Supreme Court. It is not an easy thing to be nominated by a governor to that body. I know I've had conversations with others who've advised previous governors when the governor has come to them and said, I don't like the people that I'm being asked to choose from. I don't like the process by which they were chosen through the council. And
Representative Eastman, I understand concerns about the court appointments, but this is not a court appointment. This is the Attorney General. I'm a little confused about court appointments have anything to do with it.
Well, we're talking about deference to our Supreme Court, and I heard from our Attorney General that her deference is to the Supreme Court, and there is very little questioning that goes on. And there's tension, there's natural tension between the branches of government and, of course, the Supreme Court being the example of the judiciary branch. And you've resolved that tension in some of your questions by deferring, but I'm not sure that is the right way to resolve that tension. I don't believe our founders intended for that tension to be resolved. I think they intended for that tension to remain, as messy as that sometimes be. And we talked about another state where an attorney general had, you know, sued the governor several times, which is messy. But that belies the question, was the governor, in fact, violating the law? If he was, then I think that's messy, because the governor was the one who created that mess. And it's not for the attorney general to try and clean it up, but to acknowledge the mess is there, and to, in all circumstances, give their deference first towards our state constitution, and from then, you know, resolve whatever tensions are able to be resolved. And if you can't, then you just can't. So to the committee, because I and my district have a very fundamental philosophical difference with the nominee, I will be voting against confirmation on this committee. But I hope that over the next few days and period of time, the Attorney General does review that information, and if there's additional information, maybe my vote will change on the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. I will just note, Representative Eastman, that we actually don't make a recommendation in this committee. We're just making a decision to forward the name to the floor, and whether you approve or don't approve is where you vote on the floor. There's no vote here on this committee about whether you support the nomination or don't support the nomination, but I think you have articulated a view. I will just note just a couple of things, and some of these are on a more personal level. Unlike your experience with the governor, who you'd never met him before, you applied for the Supreme Court, as you know. I have been involved in trial matters with the Attorney General, both on when we were on the same side and on the other side. And I was pleased when you applied for the Supreme Court, as you know. I wrote a letter to the governor after you made it to the Judicial Council strongly endorsing your appointment to the Supreme Court. And I was thrilled when he named you as Attorney General, because more than anything else, in my experience, you maintain the highest ethics in our profession, and that you put that at the top of your list of things to do. And I couldn't ask for more in an attorney general. I can't ask for somebody that I will agree on every piece of legal analysis. That's part of the profession, that you don't always agree. I have the utmost confidence that on matters affecting the state, you will advocate on behalf of the state's interest in the front of the Supreme Court, and that if all goes well, you will always win. Reality tells me sometimes you won't, but that doesn't diminish my confidence in your serving in this role for this governor. And so, on just a personal note, I just want to say I will be thank you for taking the time today. I have appreciated all the time we've gotten to know each other over the years in a professional capacity, and now that you're serving as Attorney General, we see you far more than I ever saw you in Anchorage. So that's those are all good things. And that closes comments from the committee. Representative Fanster.
Yes, the Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Jana Lindemuth, Attorney General, Department of Law. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
I object.
Mr. Representative Eastman, your objection is noted. Thank you. After we adjourn, please stay behind to sign the Confirmation Committee report, which we will circulate as we proceed on. Thank you very much, Ms. Lindemuth, for joining us. And we still have one more item we're going to try to get through today. I think everyone is still available till 5. I'm not seeing any. I know we've lost Representative Ledoux, but we still have a quorum. If all are able to continue forward. I'm not hearing anybody saying no. We have our second order of business is House Bill 104, Repeal Collection of Civil Litigation Info, sponsored by the House Judiciary Committee. This is the first hearing on the bill in the Judiciary Committee, and I'll remind the committee that it is in our intent to move this bill, House Bill 104, out of committee today. And part of the reason I want to keep going forward today is because Suzanne DiPietro, who is head of the Judicial Council, is here in person, so I would prefer to have her live while she's here rather than do this all telephonically. Here to present the bill is Lizzie Kubitz, the committee aide to the House Judiciary Committee. If you could please come to the table, identify yourself for the record, and begin your presentation.
Hello. For the record, my name is Lizzie Kubitz, and I'm staff to Chair Clayman as well as your committee aide. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. House Bill 104 eliminates the automatic reporting of information about civil case settlements currently required by law. The bill follows the advice of the Alaska Judicial Council, which has recommended that the legislature eliminate this requirement. To provide some historical context, in 1997, responding to public interest in tort reform and the work of the governor's advisory task force on civil justice, the legislature passed tort reform legislation. One part of the legislation responded to the task force's recommendation that the Alaska Judicial Council report on civil cases using data from forms completed by attorneys and parties in the cases. Since then, pursuant to statute, the Judicial Council has collected data provided by attorneys and litigants and has produced three reports. However, much more often than not, attorneys and litigants have failed to comply with the reporting requirement. In its most recent report from November 2011, included in your bill packets, the Alaska Judicial Council reports that from January 2001 through December 2010, 88,873 cases were resolved in the Alaska court system that were subject to the reporting requirement. Because each case had at least two parties, the council should have received 177,746 or more reports. However, the council received only 23,257 reports. This represents 13% of the council's conservative estimate of the number of reports it should have received. The low rate of reporting is the reason the council has not issued a report since 2011. An analysis based on 13% of potentially available data would not be reliable. Eliminating the requirement has also received support from attorneys and civil litigants, as the reporting requirement is onerous for those who follow it and unenforceable for those who don't. The Alaska Judicial Council lacks the authority and resources to enforce this outdated requirement, and the council renews its recommendation that the legislature eliminate it. I could provide a brief sectional analysis of the bill, but I think due to time, I'll just mention that copies of Rule 41A3, Rules 511C and E, and Alaska Statute 0968130 have all been included in your bill packets. Before I conclude, I'll mention for the record that Suzanne DiPietro, the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, is present and available to answer questions. So thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 104.
Any questions for Ms. Kubitz? Because we're going to have Ms. DiPietro up as well. So, but questions for Ms. Kubitz, go ahead. Representative Reinbold.
It's quick. It appears, you know, we've been looking into this bill for a few weeks, and it appears that we can't find pushback. It's a very simple question. I actually think this is something, once again, that I can find agreement with you on, Mr. Chairman. But I guess what my question, is there any pushback in regards to this?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, not that I'm aware of. This bill has actually received a lot of support from various attorneys. I think we have a few who would like to testify. I don't know if we'll get time to hear them, but they have to take time out of their schedule to report and file these reports, and they get to bill for that time too. And so their clients have to pay for that as well. And the data is very limited that the Alaska Judicial Council is receiving. And therefore, they don't see a purpose in continuing to have this requirement. And so I haven't seen any objection to this, only support so far.
Any further follow-up, Representative Reinbold? Any questions from anyone else?
Well, Representative Kopp. Mr. Chairman, when I was on the council in 2007 and 2008, this was an issue before us. Then it was seen as... I don't know if arcane is the right word, but it was outdated, not utilized, in information that no one was seeking or collating in the council. The staff was asking at the time to what the process was for doing away with this law. I just wanted to bring it up. This is not a new thing. It's about a decade now. I know this is. They've been looking at this.
Right. So I don't see any further questions for. Oh, go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and this may be a question you can answer. I'm not sure, or maybe the presenter is able. Now, I'm just wondering on, the conditional effect clause line beginning on line 10 of page 1, and I am not familiar with this portion of the Constitution. Is it your understanding that the Constitution does not permit the Supreme Court to make any amendments to these rules and that the legislature is the only one that has that prerogative?
Representative Eastman, using the Constitution, yeah, it's the section that I think we're referring to is Section 3 of the bill, which mentions that the Act takes effect only if the Act receives two-thirds majority vote of each House required by Article 4, Section 15, and in the Constitution, Section 15 is the rulemaking power. So the Supreme Court shall make and promulgate rules governing the administration of all courts. It shall make and promulgate rules governing practice and procedure in civil and criminal cases in all courts. These rules may be changed by the legislature by two-thirds vote of the members elected to each House. So that would be my answer to that.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Sure. You could.
And of course, I'm reading the same Constitution you are, and just wanting to make sure that that there isn't anything the Supreme Court can do without our action in this situation. Is that right?
And
through the chair,
Representative answering
Eastman,
that, go ahead.
As far as I know, however, if Suzanne DiPietro would like to,
why don't we get
provide any
get
other
Suzanne DiPietro? To
okay.
Do you have any other questions for Ms. Kubitz? Ms. DiPietro, if you could come up.
Good evening. For the record, my name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. And just
because Representative Reinbold was whispering me to ask one question, confirm whether or not you were a member of the Alaska Bar.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I am a member of the Alaska Bar.
Okay. But go ahead and answer Representative Eastman's question first.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, so the rules referenced 41 and I think it's 510, which is the appellate rule, were promulgated in order to implement the statute that the legislature passed. So the court has rulemaking ability, and the Supreme Court can change its rules, but these particular rules were, as I understand it, promulgated in order to implement the statute, which does not provide a mechanism for the certification. So the rule requires certification of attorneys who settle a case. So that's not part of the statute. That's part of the rules. So I'm not sure I answered your question sufficiently.
Follow up, very much for trying. Yes. So is there action the Supreme Court can take to amend this rule at this point, or
Rule 41?
Yes, Rule 41.
The court, I guess I'm speculating a little bit through the chair, but I believe that the court could amend the rule.
Follow up through the chair.
Sure, go ahead.
Have they declined to do so? Is that why it's before us? If they could change it, why is it before us is my question.
Representative Eastman, I'll let Ms. DiPietro answer that question if she can.
Well, I'm not through the chair. I'm not sure that I can answer the question except to say that it's customary when a rule and a statute are traveling together or attempting to implement the same purpose for the legislature to do it in this manner.
Yes, yes.
And I see we have been joined by the general counsel of the court system if we need further, but I'll hear from Representative Kopp, and then I'll offer a thought on that after Representative Kopp speaks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We may be thinking the same thought, but this court rule that we have is in response to our legislation. So that's why there's a court rule. And so naturally the court would want us to pass the bill if we no longer want it to change the rule. They're not going to be inclined to change a rule that they adopted to a statute that we passed. So we are now saying, no, we don't want to do that anymore. I'm sure the court would greatly rather prefer us to go through the process of changing the rules. Is that your thought, Mr.?
Yes, I agree 100%. In fact, I might note Representative Eastman, you are inquiring about earlier about what some would describe as activist judges, and one could suggest that if there's a statute on the books that the court actively decides to repeal the authority to collect information, that would be activist judges ignoring the intent of the legislature, whereas if we instead both repeal the rule and repeal the statute that whereby they were collecting the information, there's no suggestion that there's activist judges. Instead, it's the legislature acting in its role as legislature, and the bill combines both repealing the statute but also repealing the rule that requires lawyers to provide the information that was asked for under the statute. And so if you repealed the rule or the statute and then later said to the court, why now go back and repeal the rule, I mean, I guess they could do that, but it seems like we're making more work for them than we need to. I'm not sure if
that's very admirable. Thank you.
I'm not sure if that you need to add it now. And before you leave, since you're here, I will just ask if anyone on the committee has any questions for Ms. DiPietro. I see no questions. Thank you very much. And since there are no more questions for the sponsor or for Ms. DiPietro, I will open the public testimony on House Bill 104. And I currently see two people online that wanted to testify. Mr. Jacobus, are you still with us? And I know you've been there for more than an hour and a half. Are you still there, Mr. Jacobus?
Yes, of course, Chairman.
Okay, go ahead and state your affiliation and your name and tell us your thoughts about House Bill 104.
Okay, my name is Ken Jacobus. I'm an attorney in Anchorage. I'm representing myself plus the Anchorage Bar Association. Let me try to address a question which was addressed by the committee here.
Hold on just a minute, Mr. Jacobus.
Eddie's.
Move back a little bit from the microphone and slow down a little bit. The secretary you're going just a little too rapidly for her taste.
A little too rapidly. Okay, is this all right?
Is that better? Say something so she can check the sound level. Count to 10.
The court can amend the bar rules or the court rules, but it can't repeal the statute. Does that work for the secretary?
She's very happy now.
Okay. I actually discussed this matter with the court rules attorney and was told that the matter of repealing the rules would be presented to the appellate rules committee and to the appellate rules committee and to the civil rules committee, but what they would do is defer to the legislature because the rules are implementing the statute. So the ball is really in your court. It's not in the court's court. The two comments I want to make about the statute is you've got to look at the 2011 report. That's already been discussed. The data that's collected is not meaningful. The interesting thing is that I thought about during the Attorney General's confirmation was that the civil section of the Attorney General's office has a lot of civil attorneys that do work which is required to be reported. The statute AS 0968-130 does not provide an exception for the Attorney General's office. So either the Attorney General's office is not reporting, in which case it's disobeying the law, or they are reporting and wasting a lot of public money providing this worthless data because they're using attorney's time, which could be better spent on enforcing the law. The other comment that I want to make is I talked to an attorney in my office today who was going to be here testifying, but her baby was sick. She's an attorney who's experienced, who writes wills, does trusts and estates, does litigation, but her litigation has to do with estates, probate, and guardianships. Those are exceptions under the statute. She had a civil case last year, and I just asked her recently, well, did you report the result in the civil case, because that was required to be reported? Her answer was, I didn't know I was supposed to report that civil case. And now so I get in trouble because I haven't reported it. This illustrates a big problem, and that's a lot of attorneys aren't even aware of their duty to report. It's not something which is taught to attorneys or tested on. There's a requirement in the court that if you want to close a case, get a judge or settlement, you have to certify to the court that you will comply with the civil case reporting requirement. I believe that there are a lot of certifications to the court that this has been done when in fact it's not followed through. This statute just has all sorts of problems and it needs to be repealed. If anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. By the way, I personally report and I treat it as an administrative expense, but a lot of people don't do that. They bill their clients for this reporting, and the forms are complicated.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jacobus.
Thank you.
I don't see any questions from the committee. The next person I have online is Sarah Badten. Sarah, can you hear us? Are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead and state your name and let us know any affiliation you may have.
Thank you. My name's Sarah Batten. I've been an attorney in Anchorage for about 10 years, and I practice a lot of contract enforcement, and I've been filling out these forms for 10 years, and I've been testifying with Ken Jacobus on this for the past 2 years, trying to get this passed because it is a complete waste of time. It is a complete waste of money. I bill my time, which is often passed through to one of the parties in the contract that I'm enforcing, which I believe is unfair. And not only that, the purpose of this statute was to collect data based on tort reform. But to the extent that my reporting does anything, which it doesn't, I skew the data because I do not practice tort law. And I think that some of the focus needs to be not on the fact that people don't fill this form out, but rather on the information that is filled out is not completely unnecessary. Nobody is looking at this data. Why are we requiring this? It is archaic, and I strongly hope that we can get this repealed this session. Thank you.
And I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Thank you very much, Ms. Batten. I don't see anyone else from the LIO or otherwise calling in. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing in this matter. Is there any further questions for the bill presenter or Ms. DiPietro? Hearing and seeing none, any final comments from committee members? Representative Reinbold.
Just want to say I like most repeal bills. I wish we could get a few more like Senate Bill 91. But anyway, couldn't help myself. But anyway, I'm just thankful that I've asked in the past that we do an entire session on repeals. There's a lot of stuff that I think is not applicable any longer. And I personally can't imagine, I mean, that there's just so many laws there, and all the regulations and policies and everything that I'm thrilled that we have a repeal on the table. I personally have a hard time following just the Ten Commandments, let alone the thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of law that we have on the book. So thank you for, this is one I'm not going to object to from the bringing it forth as a committee bill, and I just appreciate you bringing it forth.
Any other comments from the committee? Hearing and seeing none, may I have a motion? Representative Fansler.
I move House Bill 104, version 30-LS0393D from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, the motion passes. House Bill 104 moves from committee. Please stay after the committee meeting to sign the committee report. And as a note, we will not be hearing House Bill 69 today. If you had any doubt, we clearly don't have time. We will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be Friday, February 24th at 1:30 p.m. Please stay tuned for what bills we will be hearing. I'm not sure if we can hear Bill 69, HB 16. We're not going to hear HB 69 on Friday at City Lizzie telling me we won't. So stay tuned as to whether we'll hear anything on Friday. If we're not, we will send out an email canceling the meeting, and I'll probably announce it on the floor. But we will stand adjourned now. The time is 4:56 p.m., and thank you for staying late.